The waiter brought coffee and hot water with lemon and some little equal thingies. I put a little cream and sugar in mine. Susan squeezed the lemon into the water and stirred in a packet of equal.
So, Teddy said, looking at the room, what do you need?
There's a town out west, a place called Potshot. It's being harassed by a bunch of bad guys, and the cops can't seem to do much.
They got the wrong cops, Sap said.
They do, I said. Sap picked his coffee cup up and held it in both hands while he took a sip.
Let me guess, he said to Susan. He's going to ask me if I want to go out there with him and straighten things out.
How could you know? Susan said.
Gay intuition, Sap said.
Of course, Susan said. Sap looked at me.
How many bad guys, he said.
30 or 40, I said.
How many guys you got?
Counting you, 3.
There's 2 guys you asked ahead of me, Sap said.
They were closer to home. Sap grinned.
Aside from the fun of going out to West Bumfuck, excuse me, Susan, in August to shoot it out with 40 hoodlums, what's in it for me?
You get to work with me again, I said.
Hot diggity, Sap said.
And I'll pay you a lot. Sap nodded and drank some more coffee.
Place closes the month of August, so everybody can have vacation.
What could be more convenient, I said.
You planning on hiring anybody else?
I have a few more in mind, I said. Sap looked at Susan. He said,
how do you feel about all of this?
I wish you were a portrait painter, Susan said, but then he wouldn't be him, would he?
And that would be a bad thing, Teddy said.
Susan smiled. Yes, God help me, that would be a bad thing.
And you a shrink, Sap said.
When you two get through doing Sonny and Cher, I said, could we sort of focus on the reason I'm here?
Which is to recruit me, Sap said.
Yes.
Okay, Sap said.
Okay, we'll focus, or okay, you're in?
Okay, I'm in, Sap said, though I may have to have Susan talk to Ben.
The ophthalmologist, Susan said. Teddy nodded.
Him, he said.
How long have you been together, Susan said.
12 years.
Do you think Ben wants you to be different than you are?
No, Sap said and grinned. I guess he only has eyes for me.
Susan sighed. Chapter 21. In late July in southeastern Nevada, the temperature is 100 and the sun shines every day. No one much cares about this in Las Vegas because everything is air-conditioned and everyone is inside, losing money. I was at the bar in the Mirage, nursing a beer, playing the dollar slots, and waiting for Susan to get rid of $50 playing blackjack. She had brought $50 to gamble with, and since she didn't really know how to play blackjack, it wouldn't take long. I had tried to explain to her that the object was not to spend it, but to try to win more with it. I am pretty sure she didn't believe me. Bernard J. Fortunato was across the way with a dark-haired woman in spike heels who would have been taller than he was in her stocking feet. They were playing blackjack. Bernard was looking good in a blue seersucker suit, pink shirt, pink and white striped tie, and a snap-brim straw hat with a pink hatband. I waited. It was bad form in Vegas to break someone's concentration while he was losing his money. I was in no hurry. I had 10 more dollar coins to give to the slots at the bar. Occasionally I would win, but I was undeterred. I would keep feeding coins into the slot until they were gone. After a while, Bernard J. Fortunato and his tall companion had won enough, or lost enough, I couldn't tell which, and headed for the bar where I sat. He spotted me while he was still halfway across the casino floor. He stopped and stood motionless while he looked at me, trying to remember. Then he came the rest of the way to the bar and stood in front of me.
"Spencer," he said.
I nodded. Bernard looked around.
"Hawk with you?"
"No." Bernard nodded as if this information confirmed his suspicions. He put a hand on the brunette's arm.
"This is Terry," he said.
Terry smiled and put her hand out. She had on a short, flowered summer dress with thin shoulder straps. She was quite beautiful, with big eyes and a wide mouth. All of her that showed, which was considerable, was pretty good. She was carefully made up, and probably somewhat older than she looked.
"Very pleased to meet you," she said.
"And you," I said. They sat at the bar. Bernard sat beside me, and Terry sat beside him.
"What are you drinking?" Bernard said.
"I'm all set," I said. The bartender came down the bar.
"Couple of Mai Tais," Bernard said.
The bartender went away. Bernard looked at me sidelong with his head tilted.
"What are you doing here?" he said.
"I'm looking for you," I said.
"Why?"
"Confidential," I said. The bartender came back with 2 Mai Tais and set them on the bar on little paper napkins. Bernard said to Terry,
"Take your Mai Tai a couple of stools down the bar while I talk with this guy."
"Sure,"
Terry said, and picked up her drink and her napkin and moved down to the end of the bar. She didn't seem to mind. When we were alone, Bernard said,
"So?
Still got that short colt?"
"Sure."
"Want to make some money?"
"How much?"
"A lot."
"Sure."
"You want to know what you have to do?" I said.
"Let's get right to the amount," Bernard said.
I told him.
"And expenses?" Bernard said.
"Yes."
"Okay," he said. "What do you need done?"
I told him.
"Hawk in on it?" he said.
"Yes."
"Some others?"
"Yes."
"How many?"
"So far, counting you and me, 5.
"You got some other guys in mind?"
"I'm working west," I said.
"L.A.?" he said.
"Yes."
"Okay. What's first?"
"First," I said, "is you drive down to Potshot and rent us a house. Talk to a local broker down there, J. George Taylor." I handed him one of my business cards with Taylor's name and address on the back. "House should be big enough for 6-7 guys. Use any name you want as long as it matches your car registration. Move in. When you got a phone, call me. Don't say anything much to anybody about anything." Bernard looked at me disgustedly.
"Don't talk? What do I look like, blabbermouth Bobby? I done this kind of work before."
"Good to hear," I said.
"And I'm a cash-and-carry business, up front."
I took a checkbook from my inside pocket and wrote out a check and ripped it out and handed it to Bernard. He looked at it to make sure it was done properly, then he folded it and put it in his wallet.
"This clears, I'll head down to Potshot," he said. "I'll let you know."
I stood. Bernard jerked his head at Terry, who smiled and picked up her drink and moved back down the bar beside him.
"Nice to have met you," she said to me.
"You too," I said. Bernard gestured at the bartender.
2 more Mai Tais," he said.
I left. Chapter 22. "But I don't want to stay at 19, Susan said. "I want him to hit me." "But unless he hits you with an ace or a 2, I said, "you bust." "But staying is boring," she said. "Of course it is," I said.
"You're humoring me."
"Of course I am." We were in Beverly Hills, walking up Rodeo Drive, the silliest street in America, holding hands, discussing blackjack. "But what's wrong with my approach?" Susan said. "It guarantees that you'll lose."
"I'm going to lose anyway."
"Very likely," I said, "but the point of the exercise is to try to win."
"I get bored standing there waiting for the proper cards."
I nodded. We were quiet for a little while as we marshaled our arguments.
"Are you thinking sexist things?" Susan said.
"Like, women, harumph," I said.
"Like that," she said.
"Not me." Susan smiled. We were staying in a hotel at the foot of Rodeo Drive. We liked the hotel. It was expensive, but I'd gotten a supportive advance from the Potshot cabal. And we were right in the heart of Beverly Hills, so we had continuous access to comic relief.
"So much to buy," Susan said. "So little time. How long do you think we'll be here?"
"I need to do a little background on Stephen and Mary Lou Buckman," I said.
"I need a new wardrobe," she said, "for fall."
"Didn't you buy a new fall wardrobe last year?" She gave me a withering look.
How will you go about checking on the Buckmans? She said.
I'll start with Mark Samuelson. He's the one who sent Mary Lou to me.
Why are you checking on them?
Better to know than not know, I said. Nothing seems quite plumb in Potshot. I want to know about them before they went there. In fact, it might help if I knew why they went there.
To get away?
From what?
It would probably be good to know that, too, Susan said.
Hey, I said, you're detecting. That's man's work. Susan ignored me, which probably accounts for the longevity of our relationship.
I have women's work to do, she said. Why don't you go about your business and let me do it?
Which I did.
Chapter 23
Mark Samuelson had been a lieutenant with a drooping mustache and no hair when I last did business with him. Now that I was doing business with him again, he was clean-shaven, a captain, and had no hair. He was still wearing his tinted aviator glasses, and he had a healthy outdoor look about him. His office was in the Parker Center now. It was bigger. It had higher partition walls, and the air conditioning worked.
You look the same, he said.
Yeah, I said. Crying shame, isn't it?
You working with Mary Lou Buckman?
Yeah.
And you want to know what I know about her?
And her husband, I said.
My oldest kid played for him at Fairfax High, Samuelson said. That's how I know him.
Samuelson had his coat off and his gun was high on his hip on the right side.
He used to ask me to come talk to the kids a few times, warn them to stay out of trouble, rah-rah them about physical fitness and staying clean, that kind of crap, bored the shit out of the kids.
What kind of coach was he?
He was a hard-on, Samuelson said. He thought he was Vince Lombardi.
Kids like him?
Nobody liked him. A lot of kids quit.
Yours didn't?
No. Ricky's good. He couldn't afford to quit. He was in line for a full ride at San Diego State.
He get the scholarship, I said?
Yeah, wide receiver.
Buckman help with that?
Buckman didn't help with anything. When the college coaches were around looking at the kids, Buckman was trying so hard to impress them that he got in the way.
Looking for an assistance job?
Looking to be head coach, I think.
Too late now, I said.
He have a temper?
Yeah. I don't know how real it was. He was one of those guys who thought he ought to have a temper. Liked people to be scared of him, you know? Watch out for Steve. He's got a temper. He's been in the Marines. Figured he could chew up a crowbar.
Was he any good?
Oh, he could bully the kids okay, Samuelson said. And he probably won all the fights in the faculty lounge. But you and me have spent most of our lives with genuine tough guys, Samuelson said. Buckman was just another Semper Fi asshole.
How come he left coaching?
Got me, Samuelson said. Ricky graduated 3 years ago. I lost interest.
How about the wife?
I met her a few times. She was okay as far as I knew.
They have any trouble at home?
Samuelson shrugged.
I'm not their pal, Samuelson said. When she come in here, told me her husband got clipped in the desert, I wasn't sure who she was.
You look into it at all?
Samuelson got up and went to a coffee machine and poured a cup. He looked at me. I shook my head.
Yeah, a little. Called a guy I know out there, Dick in the sheriff's department, named Callie Dark. He said the case was dry. Said he probably got whacked by a bunch of local thugs, but there was no evidence and no witnesses and nothing that looked like a lead.
So you passed her on to me, I said.
Always looking to help out, Samuelson said.
You bet, I said.
She asked me who could help her. I figured you could make something out of nothing if it got your attention.
First time I saw you out here, I made nothing out of something, I said.
You had a bad run, but I liked the way you handled yourself.
Better than I did, I said.
I've fucked a few cases myself, Samuelson said.
People get killed?
Once or twice.
I shrugged.
Where'd she get the money, I said.
To pay you?
Yeah, wife of a high school football coach. How much could she have saved up?
She's good-looking, Samuelson said. Maybe she figured there'd be some way to broker a deal.
It's a thought, I said.
Chapter 24 Fairfax High School is located at the corner of Fairfax and Melrose.
not very far from CBS and the Farmer's Market down Fairfax, and excitingly close to the center of black lipstick and body piercing a little further east on Melrose. The principal looked like a short John Thompson, black, about 6'5" and heavy. I introduced myself. He shook hands.
Arthur Atkins.
He asked to see some ID. I provided some. He read it carefully.
You are a private investigator, he said.
Yes.
Well, you look like you can handle the job.
You look like you could provide firm guidance yourself, I said, to rebellious teenagers.
We got school police with shotguns. They helped me.
Are sock hops waning in popularity?
Waning, Atkins said. You wanted to talk to me about Steve Buckman?
Yes.
You say he's been killed?
Yep.
How did he die? Atkins said.
He was murdered.
Jesus Christ, Atkins said. What do you need to know?
Anything you can tell me, I said. I'm just feeling my way around in the dark.
Aren't we all? Atkins said.
Was he a good football coach? Atkins paused a moment, thought about it, and decided.
Not for us, he said. This isn't the NFL. Any coach wants to win, but it's also about the kids, about learning to work hard and achieve some self-control and respect one another and win with grace and lose with dignity and cooperate and follow directions and think on their feet and, for Christ's sake, to have some fun.
Buckman get any of that?
Got the win part, though not the grace part. Got the follow directions part, as long as they were his directions.
Did he leave voluntarily?
No, I fired him.
Any specific reason other than being a jerk?
I don't even remember the official reason. There always has to be one, but that was the real reason.
How'd he take that?
He said it was a racial thing. Said he was going to kick my ass.
Did he?
He figured he was a pretty tough guy, Atkins said. Been in the Marines. Was a running back at Pacific Lutheran.
And?
I've been in the Marines and played football.
Where'd you play?
SC.
Offensive tackle?
Very.
So what happened between you and Buckman?
I invited him to the office and offered him the chance to kick my ass.
He take it? Atkins smiled.
No.
He have any kind of part-time job, I said.
Most teachers do. I think he was a personal trainer.
At a gym?
No, takeout. He'd come to your home.
Besides coaching, I said, did he teach something?
Atkins smiled. Typing, he said.
Could he type?
I don't think so, but we had to do something with him. We don't pay enough to hire a coach just to coach.
Know anything about the outfitting business he ran in the desert?
I think that was mostly the wife, Atkins said.
How about the wife?
Lou, he said. He met her in college, I think. She was pleasant, perky at social events. I don't really know her.
She work as well, I asked.
I think she worked with the DWP.
Department of Water and Power?
Yep.
Know what she did?
Nope.
Know any of her friends?
No.
They get along?
Don't know.
Anyone who would know?
Woman in our English department, Atkins said. She was pretty friendly with Buckman.
What's her name?
Sarah Hunter, he said. White girl out of Berkeley. Wants to do good. We're just a tryout for her eventual aim, which is to teach in my old neighborhood.
South Central?
Yep. Work off her upper middle class guilt.
She working it off this summer?
Not here, Atkins said. She lives in Westwood, I think. I'll give you her home address.
He found her card in his Rolodex and copied her address down on a piece of pink telephone message paper. I tucked it into my shirt pocket. You don't know much about them, I said. Is that typical?
There are people on the faculty I spend time with, Atkins said, and people I don't. I didn't like Buckman. I didn't spend time with him.
Atkins paused and sort of smiled.
You really are feeling your way along, he said.
You bet. I just try to keep you talking and see if something comes up.
Like what?
Got no idea, I said. I just hope I'll know it when I see it. You have any record of where they lived while they were here?
Maybe, Atkins said.
He consulted the Rolodex again.
You think the Buckmans weren't kosher?
I don't know enough to think anything, I said. I'm trying to find out. Atkins found the address in the Rolodex, copied it down on another piece of message paper, and gave it to me. I put it in my shirt pocket with Sarah Hunter. Atkins stood and put out his hand.
Good luck, he said.
Luck is the residue of design, I said. Atkins looked at me blankly for a minute.
I'll bet it is, he said.
Chapter 25
Steve Buckman had owned a small pink stucco house in Santa Monica on 16th Street below Montana. It had a blue front door, a flat roof, and a lemon tree in the front yard. I rang the front doorbell. Inside, a dog barked. I waited. Then a young woman with her dark hair up opened the door a crack. Behind her leg, I could see a dog trying to get a better look at me. I could hear children in the background and a television going. "I'm looking for Mr. and Mrs. Buckman."
"Excuse the door," she said, "but I don't want the dog to get out."
"Of course," I said. "Are you Mrs. Buckman?"
"Oh, God, no. I'm Sharon Costin. The Buckmans don't live here anymore."
"Did you know them when they did?" I said.
"Just when we bought the house from them."
"How about some of the other neighbors?" I said. "Would they know the Buckmans, you think?"
"People next door," the woman said. "Why you want to know?"
"I'm from the state treasurer's office," I said. "Division of abandoned property. We have some money for them." In the background, I could hear some children fighting. One of them started to cry. The dog wasn't a quitter. He kept trying to squeeze by her leg.
"Talk to the people in the next house," she said. "Name's Lewin."
She shut the door. I said thank you politely to the door and went next door. A woman wearing tennis whites opened the door. She had long blonde hair, good legs, and a nice tan.
"I saw you next door," she said. "You selling something?"
I smiled my open, friendly smile, and told my lie about abandoned property.
"Oh, sure, Steve and Lou Buckman. Mary Lou."
"You know them?"
"Knew them. We lived next door for what? I was pregnant with my first when we moved here, so 9 years."
"What can you tell me about them?"
"They moved out east someplace," she said. "Town with a funny name."
"Potshot," I said.
"Yes, that's it. They had some sort of business out there."
"They get along?"
"Well as anybody, I guess. What's that got to do with abandoned property?"
"Nothing," I said with a big, sincere smile. "I just heard that he fooled around." The woman laughed.
"Oh, hell," she said. "They both did. I think my ex may have had a little fling with Lou."
"A lot of that going around," I said. "You know what business they had in Potshot?"
"I don't know. Something to do with camping. You should talk to Nancy Ratliff. She and her ex were pretty tight with the Buckmans."
"Where would I find her?"
"She's still here," the woman said, and nodded at a small white house with blue trim. "Across the street."
"And your ex-husband?"
She laughed sourly. "Mr. Hot Pants," she said. "Don't know. Don't care."
"Thanks," I said.
"I don't want to tell you your job," the woman said, "but if I were you, I'd lose that abandoned property story."
I grinned at her. "It's gotten me this far," I said. She shrugged. I walked across the street and rang the Ratliff bell, and the door opened at once. I had caused the neighborhood alert.
"Mrs. Ratliff?"
"Yes."
"I'm from the Bureau of Abandoned Property." I was glad the blonde across the street couldn't hear me.
"What the hell is that?" Mrs. Ratliff said.
She was petite, with thick black hair and sharp features. "State Treasurer's Office," I said. "We have some money for Mr. and Mrs. Buckman."
"Lucky them," the woman said. "You want to come in?"
"Thank you," I said. I sometimes wished I wore a hat, so when I went into a woman's house, I could impress them by taking it off in a gentlemanly way. I settled for removing my sunglasses. The front door opened immediately to her living room, which was done in Indian rugs and hand-hewn furniture that was too big for the room. There was a little gray stone fireplace with gas jets on the end wall. There was a pitcher of martinis on the glass-topped coffee table that took up too much of the room.
"I'm having a cocktail," she said. "Would you care to join me?"
It was 3:30.
Sure, I said. She went through an archway to the small dining room and came back with a martini glass in which there were two olives. She poured me a martini.
Stirred, not shaken, she said.
I smiled. She picked up her glass and gestured toward me with it.
Chink, chink, she said.
I touched her glass with mine and we each took a drink. The martini was dreadful. Not cold enough and far too much vermouth.
So, Nancy Ratliff said, what can I do for you?
Tell me about Stephen and Mary Lou Buckman.
Well, she was a bitch. Still is, I'm sure.
How so? I said. Nancy Ratliff took another drink. She didn't appear to know that the martini was dreadful. Or maybe she knew and didn't care.
Well, for one thing, she was fucking my husband.
How nice for them, I said.
Yeah, well, not so nice for me.
How did Mr. Buckman feel about it?
He didn't say.
She drank again and stared into her glass.
Well, actually he did, she said. He said we should get even with them.
Tit for tat, I said, just to be saying something, though in the context the choice of words was unfortunate. We were silent while she looked into her martini glass. Finally she said,
aren't you going to ask me if we did?
Only if you want to tell me, Mrs. Ratliff.
Nancy, she said, and yeah, I want to tell you.
I smiled happily. She didn't say anything. I waited. She poured herself some more bad martini from the pitcher where the melting ice would have diluted it by now. She took another sip and held her glass up and looked through it.
I like how clear it looks, she said.
I nodded helpfully. Friendly guy from the treasurer's office, eager to please, eager to listen.
Yes, we got even, she said, in goddamned spades.
And how did Mr. Ratliff feel about that, I said. I had no idea where I was going, except that Ratliff was a name I'd heard before.
He left me and went chasing after her.
And Mr. Buckman?
He went too.
With his wife, I said.
I don't know, I guess so. Maybe they were all doing it, a traveling gangbang.
She looked at my glass.
You're not drinking, she said.
I'm savoring it slowly, I said. What is your husband's first name?
Ex-husband. I divorced him. The bastard didn't even show up to contest the divorce. I took him for everything he had, except he didn't have anything.
She drank again.
Movie producer, she snorted. Sure.
And his first name?
Mark.
I felt very still for a moment inside, and then I took a stab at something. You happen to know anyone named Dean Walker, I said.
The cop?
Yeah, used to live three houses up toward Montana. Moved away 8, 9 years ago. He a friend of the Buckmans?
I guess, yeah, he'd be at parties sometimes. Him and his wife.
You remember her name?
Judy, I think.
He have anything to do with Mrs. Buckman?
Dean? I don't know. She'd have been willing. She was like a bitch in heat. But Dean seemed sort of straightforward. If he was fucking her, I don't know about it.
Each time she said fucking, she said it with relish, as if she liked to say it, as if it were a counter-irritant, like scratching an old itch. Forgive and forget didn't seem to work for her. Chapter 26. Sarah Hunter lived in a faux Tudor three-unit condo in Westwood, a block below Wilshire. She was L.A. serious, which meant a loose-fitting, ankle-length flowered dress, some Native American jewelry, and dark leather sandals. Her blonde hair was done in a single long braid that reached nearly to her waist. She wore no makeup, and despite her best efforts, she was pretty good-looking. When she opened the door, she kept the chain bolt on. I gave her my card. I introduced myself. I explained what I wanted, and I smiled at her. None of it seemed to make her more welcoming.
"Why do you want to talk to me about Steve Buckman?" she said. "He's just somebody I knew at work."
"Well, that's why," I said. "I was hoping for some of your insights."
She liked insights. "Why do you want that?" she said.
There was never a good way to say it. I'd learned over the years to just say it. which I did. Steve's been murdered. She looked at me as if I had commented on the dandiness of the weather.
What?
We could talk out here on the porch, I said, if you'd feel more secure. She didn't speak for a moment, then she closed the door, unchained it, opened it again, and stepped out. She was careful to pull the door shut behind her. The porch extended along the front of her condo to form a little veranda, and we sat on some wicker chairs out there. Across the street a couple of Mexicans were trimming a hedge, and on the sidewalk below the veranda, a shapeless middle-aged woman with bright red hair was walking a small, ugly, possumy-looking dog on a retractable leash.
"Tell me about Steve," I said.
She leaned forward a little, resting her elbows on her thighs, and put her face into her hands. I waited. She sat. Maybe overreaction was endemic. Or maybe she was a very dramatic person. Or maybe Steve was more than someone she knew at work. After a while, I said, "How you doing?" Without taking her face from her hands, she shook her head. "Take your time," I said. The lady walking her possum turned the corner at Wilshire and disappeared. One of the gardeners across the street was edging the grass now with a noisy power trimmer.
"Did he suffer much?"
Sarah said finally. "He was probably dead before he knew he'd been shot," I said. I didn't know that, but I saw no reason not to say it.
"Did she do it?" Sarah said.
She was still in her position of official mourning, and as she talked, she rocked a little, forward and back.
"She?" I said. "Mary Lou, did she kill him?"
"I don't know. You think?"
She raised her head. "I think that she would do anything."
"Really?" I said.
"You wouldn't see it. You're a man."
"And you're a woman," I said.
"What?"
Just trying to hold up my end of the conversation, I said.
"Well, you wouldn't. She'd fool you. Blue eyes, cute, sweet. She'd show you her dimples and ask for your help, and you'd be falling over yourself like some big puppy."
"Woof," I said.
"You can laugh at me if you want to," Sarah said a little pouty, "but it's true."
"Probably is," I said. "Why do you think she might have killed him?"
"Because she couldn't control him, though she never stopped trying. She resented authenticity. She was frightened of the untamed self."
The sky was cloudless. It was 75 and bright. I could smell olive trees. "His?" I said.
"His, her own."
Sarah made a you-know-what-I-mean gesture, and her voice trailed off. "How untamed was that?" I said.
"As untamed as yours? Or mine?"
"That untamed," I said.
"You're laughing at me again."
"That was just a quizzical smile," I said. "You know this. How?"
"We were friends."
"Not just someone you knew at work."
"I'm sorry," she said. "That was reflexive. I've become used to evasion."
"The world is too much with us lately."
"My God, a literate detective."
"Goes with good looking," I said. "You and Steve were close friends?"
"Yes."
"Do you know if he had any source of income other than Fairfax High?"
"Well, they ran that camping business out in the desert. She did, really."
"Anything else?"
"No. Why do you ask?"
"Well, Mary Lou is paying me a fair sum," I said, "without complaint. Life insurance?"
"I suppose so, but I can't imagine that it was huge. A teacher's salary."
"Did Mary Lou know you and Steve were good friends?"
"I don't know what she knew. She was no trembling virgin herself."
"Mary Lou?"
"See, you're shocked, aren't you? Any woman could see through her."
"Why, that untamed vixen," I said.
"It was all right for her, but not for Steve."
"Gee, that doesn't sound fair," I said.
"No," she said, pouty again. "It wasn't."
The landscaper finished his power trimming, and the sudden quiet was almost intrusive. Then, as my ears adjusted, I could hear the traffic on Wilshire. I kept at Sarah for as long as I could stand to, but I had learned what I was going to learn from her, and I finally said goodbye and went back to Beverly Hills. Chapter 27 The hotel room was awash with tissue paper and shopping bags. Amid it all, and somehow above it, Susan was trying on some new duds and examining them carefully in the mirror.
"Would you have any interest in exploring my authentic untamed self?" I said.
"Your what?"
"My untamed self," I said.
"God, if I haven't encountered it yet, I don't think I want to."
"You got something against authenticity?" I said.
"No, I'm just afraid I'll get hurt."
"Maybe later, when I've calmed down," I said.
"Maybe," Susan said. "What brought on this sudden attack of authenticity?"
I told her about Sarah.
"We assume Sarah was having an affair with Steve Buckman," Susan said.
"Yes, but a fully authentic one," I said.
"What would an inauthentic affair be?" Susan said.
"One which used a battery-powered device."
"Do you like this skirt?" Susan said.
"I'm not sure," I said. "Better take it off and put it on again."
"Is lechery authentic?" Susan said.
"You bet," I said. Susan put on a blouse.
"So if we are to believe what's-her-name,
Sarah,
if we are to believe Sarah, then both Steve and Mary Lou are fooling around with other people, and at least from whose's perspective,
Sarah," I said.
"From Sarah's perspective, Mary Lou was, and perhaps is, a bitch."
"Sarah's perspective may be somewhat skewed," I said, "by her being a nitwit." Susan examined in the mirror the way some new pants fit her. She smiled. Apparently she was pleased. Me too.
"That skews a lot of perspectives," she said.
"Present company excluded," I said. "You want to eat?"
"Let's go someplace I can wear my new clothes," she said.
There was always something in her eyes that suggested we'd have more fun than we could imagine, whatever we did. "Does this mean I have to cancel the reservation at Fatburger?" She said that it did. She also declined Pink's for a chili dog, and we ended up at the Buffalo Club on a dark stretch of Olympic in Santa Monica. We sat together on the same side of the booth and had a Kettle One martini or two and studied the menu. We ordered some oyster shooters and pot roast and ate them. That is, I ate them. Susan had two shooters and half her pot roast, cutting the other half away before she started, and carefully putting one half on her butter plate, lest, God forfend, she should eat it by mistake and balloon to 130. I helped. I had her leftover oysters and the pot roast from her butter plate, and virtuously declined dessert. Outside, I gave the ticket to the valet and held Susan's hand while we watched the desultory traffic plod by in the dark. A silver Lexus pulled up, and two men got out. The valet went forward, and the first man shook his head. He looked like a mature surfer. Long blonde hair, pale blue eyes, sun-darkened skin, which didn't fully conceal the broken veins of a boozer on his cheeks. He was wearing a pair of brown slacks, a brown shirt buttoned to the neck, a small diamond stud in his right earlobe, and a camel-hair jacket. The jacket was unbuttoned. The guy with him was all edges and angles, small, lean, hard, pale, with spiky hair and a sharp, hooked nose. His eyes were like the windows in an empty house. He had on big shorts and a flowered shirt that hung over his belt. The surfer stopped in front of me. He stood very close.
"How you doing tonight?" he said.
I nodded slightly. I'd seen these guys before. Maybe not these particular ones, but enough guys just like them so that I was pretty sure what they were. I could feel Susan stiffen slightly beside me. The small guy in the flowered shirt moved a little to my left, balancing off the surfer who was a little to my right. The valets apparently knew these guys, too. They had disappeared.
"You Spencer?"
I hooded my eyes and spoke through my teeth.
"Who wants to know?" I said.
Beside me, Susan made a sound that was a little like a snort, but more elegant.
"She thinks I lack originality," I said to the surfer.
"Very funny," the surfer said. "You think that's very funny, Tino?"
"I think this guy could get very dead," the little sharp guy said in a flat voice. "Life on the edge," I said. "You guys want something, or is this a cabaret act?"
"We want to know your interest in the Buckmans."
"Why?"
"Why? Fuck why.
Answer what I ask you, or we'll mess you up bad. The broad, too.
I looked at Susan.
Broad? I said.
The surfer was right up against me, which was a mistake. Still looking at Susan, I put my knee hard into the surfer's groin. He gasped and doubled over, and I shoved him back into Tino. Tino almost fell, but he didn't. He steadied himself and sort of shucked the surfer off of him and put his hand toward his hip.
No, I said.
I had my gun out and steady on his navel. He stopped, his hand half under his flowered shirt. The surfer was squatting on the ground, holding his crotch and rocking gently. I could hear him breathing in gasps. Beside me, Susan's breath was moving in and out a little more quickly than normal, but I'd heard it move faster.
Turn around, I said.
Tino turned. I stepped forward and took the handgun off his hip and dropped it into the side pocket of my J-Press blue blazer. It felt heavy in there. I didn't want the jacket to sag, but it was one of the hazards of crime-fighting.
Get the blonde bomber on his feet and into your car and out of my sight, I said to Tino. Nothing fancy. I would be pleased to shoot you and watch you die.
Tino didn't look scared, but he didn't look stupid either. He helped the surfer to his feet and into the car that still stood, valet-less, at the curb. He gave me a very sharp look as he went around to get in on the driver's side.
"This ain't over," he said.
"It is for the moment," I said. Tino got in, slammed the door, put the car in gear, and floored it away from the curb, leaving the smell of burnt rubber to linger after the car was gone. I put my gun away. We looked at each other.
"You do know how to show a girl a good time," Susan said.
"I do," I said.
The valet drove up and parked my car at the curb. He got out and held the door for Susan. A second valet hustled up and held the door for me. I gave him a 10-spot and got in the car.
"Have a nice night," the valet said.
"You too," I said.
And we drove off.
Chapter 28
Susan and I didn't talk much on the way back to Beverly Hills, but when we went to bed, we made love with unusual intensity. There's a positive side to everything. In the morning, after breakfast, Susan went to the health club and I went down to the Parker Center, where Samuelson introduced me to an ID technician who showed me mug shots for maybe 4 hours. I never found Tino, but I found the surfer. His name was Jerome Jefferson, and he'd been arrested 6 times for assault. 1 conviction, no time. They gave me his last address, which was 3 years old. I pocketed it for later.
"Never heard of him," Samuelson said when I went back to his office, "which means only that he hasn't done anything bad enough to get our attention."
"Or you haven't caught him at it," I said.
Samuelson shrugged.
6 assaults? Whatever he is, he's a gopher," Samuelson said.
"How about OCU?" I said. "This wasn't his own idea. Somebody sent him."
"I'll call over there," Samuelson said. "Sheriff's department, too."
"If they don't know Jefferson," I said, "try Tino. My guess is that Jefferson's the slugger and Tino's the shooter.
Or at least that's the way it was supposed to work out."
"The way it was supposed to work out, I was supposed to get faint with fear and go right home," I said, "and never make audible mention of Steve or Mary Lou Buckman again."
"Audible mention," Samuelson said.
"I'm sleeping with a Ph.D., I said.
"You might want to talk to your friend Del Rio again," Samuelson said.
"Again?" I said. "You're keeping track of me?"
"We're keeping track of Del Rio," Samuelson said.
"He's not exactly my friend," I said.
"Well, he must like you. If he didn't, I'd be looking into your death."
"Or his," I said.
Back in my rental car, I picked up Sunset down from the Civic Center, turned up the air conditioning, and headed west. Jerome Jefferson's last known residence was a 3-story white stucco apartment building on Las Palmas just below Fountain. It had the sort of slick, sleazy look that only Los Angeles has fully mastered, with tiny, useless balconies of green iron outside the windows. There was no listing for Jerome Jefferson at the entry. I rang the bell marked Super. And after my 3rd ring, he woke up from his nap and slouched to the door in his slippers. He was wearing an old-fashioned undershirt and plaid knee-length shorts. He had a 2-day stubble, mostly gray. His long, limp hair was mostly gray and showed no sign of shower or shampoo.
"No vacancy," he said.
"I don't see why," I said.
"Huh?"
"Implied criticism," I said. "I'm looking for a guy named Jerome Jefferson. Big guy, blonde hair, looks like a boozer."
"He ain't here," the super said, "and he ain't coming back. The management company evicted him."
"Rent?"
"Yeah, fucker never paid. Company kept telling me to talk with him. You know him?"
"I've met him," I said.
"Then you know what it'd be like to try and talk with him. They don't pay me enough for me to get my teeth kicked in."
"You know where he went?" I said.
"Heard he moved in with some broad he was scoring in West Hollywood."
"Address?"
"Got no idea," the super said. "Maybe they know at the company. They've been trying to get the rent he owes them."
There was a sign beside the entry that read, "Managed by Southland Properties," with an address in Century City. "You know his friend?" I said. "Smaller guy, thin, big sharp beak." The super shook his head.
"I hope you find a bastard. You look like you might give him trouble."
"I might," I said.
"You got the build for it, anyway."
"Thanks for the encouragement," I said. He nodded blankly and closed the door and shuffled off back to his nap. Century City is a cluster of expensive high-rises just below the Los Angeles Country Club that occupies a former movie backlot between Santa Monica and Olympic. There was a big hotel there, and a shopping mall, and a theater, and a supermarket, and the offices of anyone on the west side that wanted a good address. Southland Properties was on the 15th floor of a building on Constellation Avenue, with a nice view of the Century Plaza Hotel. I was passed along the chain of command at Southland until I was in the office of their financial compliance manager, whose name, according to the nameplate on his desk, was Carl Adams. We shook hands, and he gestured me to a seat.
"Carl Adams," he said. "You're looking for Jerome Jefferson?"
Adams was about my height and lean. He looked like retired military.
"I am," I said.
"We are too," Adams said. "He owes us 6 months' rent. What's your interest?"
"I'm trying to see what his connection is to a case I'm working on." My card was lying on Adams' desk. He glanced down at it.
"In Boston?" he said.
"Town called Potshot," I said, "in the desert."
"Long way from home," Adams said.
"Anywhere I hang my hat."
"Yeah, sure," he said.
He paused and was thoughtful for a small time. Then he said,
"Don't see why not."
"Me either."
"I'll tell you what I know," Adams said, "and if you were to find him, I'd appreciate a jingle."
"Seems fair to me," I said.
"After he skipped out of the place on Las Palmas, we figure he moved in with his girlfriend on Franklin Avenue. So we went up there, but she says she's broken up with him and hasn't seen him and never wants to see him again."
"You believe her?"
"No. So we put somebody up there for a couple days, but there was no sign of him."
"Round the clock," I said.
"Hell no. We don't have the manpower for real surveillance."
"So if he didn't come and go between 9 and 5, you wouldn't know if he was there?"
"Correct."
"You got much experience skip tracing?"
"Financial compliance," Adams said. "Says so on my door."
"Sure," I said.
"I'm retired Navy," Adams said. "Intelligence. I got a lower budget here."
"You got a name and address for the girlfriend?" I said.
"Yeah."
He took one of his business cards out of a small container on his desk and wrote on the back.
"Here you go," he said. "Any directions?"
"No," I said. "I've screwed up cases out here before."
Chapter 29. The girlfriend's name was Carlotta Hopewell. She had a small, clapboard house with an overhanging roof on the front porch. The house was in Hollywood, where it crouched among the apartment buildings on Franklin Street between Gower and Vine. The yard needed work, and some of the white paint was peeling from the clapboards. As I walked up the front walk, a woman who must have been watching out the window opened the door and stepped out onto the front steps. She had a glass of white wine in her hand, and she smelled strongly of it.
"May I help you?" she said.
Her lips were pouty, and her face was puffy. She had loud blonde hair and not much muscle tone. She was wearing shorts and a short tank top that stopped several inches above her navel. Her body was pale and soft-looking.
"Carlotta Hopewell?"
Yes. I'm looking for a man named Jerome Jefferson. I'm not him.
Good, I said. That's helpful. It narrows the search.
Hey, you're kind of funny, huh?
But I have a serious side. Is Jerome staying with you?
Nah.
She swirled her wine a little. But you know him, I said.
Maybe. You want some wine?
Yes, thank you, I said. She opened the screen door and we went in. Ah, memories of things past. There was a rough woven orange rug on the floor of her living room, and a huge picture of Prince covering most of the wall above a brown suede couch. There was a brown beanbag chair and an angular black metal chair with a white canvas sling to sit in. A hall went off to my left, and through an open archway beyond the suede couch, I could see the kitchen.
"Please have a seat," she said. "I'll get you some wine."
She was gone for a minute, and when she came back, she was carrying a big jug of white wine and a glass. There was a marble-top coffee table in front of the couch, the marble marked with a large number of circular stains where glasses had been set down without coasters. She set my glass and hers on the coffee table and poured me some wine and some for herself, holding the jug in both hands. There was no air conditioning, and the bottle was already beginning to sweat in the hot room. I had a sip of wine. It wasn't very good, but it would probably prevent plaque. Carlotta raised her glass toward me and drank some.
"Good times," she said.
"So," I said, "tell me about Jerome."
"Why?"
I didn't want to appear unsociable. I drank a little more of the jug wine. My shirt was already beginning to stick to my back. "He and I are supposed to do a little, business." I smiled what I hoped was a cryptic smile. Susan had told me that sometimes my cryptic smile shaded off into a leer, which had shaken my confidence in it, but this time it seemed to work.
"Business?" she said.
"Yes, him and Tino. They told me to come here."
"You know Tino?"
"Sure." She had finished her wine already and was pouring another large, clumsy dose from the jug. When she leaned forward, I could see that she wore no bra, which was much more information than I really wanted. "Tino and Jerome and I were supposed to do a piece of business," I said, "for Jerome's boss. What's his name?" Carlotta was looking at me speculatively over her wine glass. Sweat added sheen to her forehead and glimmered faintly on her upper lip.
"Mr. Tannenbaum," she said absently.
"Yeah, Tannenbaum, and they told me to meet them here."
"Anyone ever tell you that you're a cutie?" Carlotta said.
"Jerome and Tino just said that last night." She smiled automatically and drank some wine.
"Well, you are, and don't you just know it."
"When do you expect Jerome back?" I said.
"He went to the beach for a few days," she said. "You ever fool around?"
"No, I always mean it," I said.
"Maybe you oughta," she said.
I would have been more flattered if I had the sense that she didn't proposition everyone she met, and if she wasn't drunk, and the ugly sexist truth of the matter, if her thighs weren't flabby. "You know where Mr. Tannenbaum lives?" I said.
"Lives? How the hell would I know where he lives? You think he invites me and Jerome over for cocktails? I never even met him."
"But he's in L.A. someplace," I said. She drank some wine and nodded.
"Me and Jerome never get invited any place. We eat cheap, we drink cheap, we live in this dump, and Jerome don't even pay the rent."
She began to tear up.
"Wasn't for my alimony check, we couldn't even live like we do," she said.
Her wine glass was empty. She did another two-handed pour from the jug and spilled some of it on the coffee table and began to cry.
"You want to fuck me or not?" she said through the tears.
"Anyone would," I said, "but I can't."
"Why not?"
I made a cryptic gesture and smiled a cryptic smile and stood up. When I did, I could see myself in the oval mirror that hung over the gas log fireplace on the far wall. My cryptic smile was not very convincing. It looked a little panicky. My face was sweaty. If I did not know and admire the owner,
It was not a face I'd like very much.
"Why don't you sit, drink some wine, have a little fun?"
"I wish I could," I said.
"But you're uptight," she said.
"That's it," I said. "Thanks for the wine." She was looking into her near-empty wine glass now, with her feet flat on the floor and her shoulders hunched as if she were cold, which was not possible in the stifling room.
"Get lost," she said.
Which I did. Chapter 30 Vincent Del Rio had an estate in Bel Air where he was master of all he surveyed, and a good deal more than that. The place was about the size of Worcester, Massachusetts, and a lot better looking in its flowery green Southern California way. Even though I had called first, I had to do a lot of explaining to a sequence of scary-looking men of Mexican lineage as I worked my way past the gate and past the front door and into the courtyard of his vast white stucco and red tile home, into the presence of Vincent Del Rio.
"Señor Spencer," he said.
Del Rio was wearing a white suit today with a crimson silk shirt open at the neck. I said,
"Jefe."
Del Rio smiled and sipped from a glass of iced tea. Bobby Horse was leaning against the courtyard wall with his thick arms folded. He nodded at me. I nodded back. Cholo was there, seated with Del Rio under an olive tree at a round redwood table with a brick-colored tile top. They were playing chess. Cholo was as he had been, still medium height and slender, with his long hair and a ponytail. Even seated, he managed to look languid, which he wasn't. On the table were a pitcher of iced tea and a dish of sliced lemons, several glasses, and the chessboard.
"Sit down," Del Rio said.
I sat between him and Cholo. Cholo said,
"Amigo?"
I said,
"Cholo?"
"You want some iced tea?" Del Rio said.
"Gracias."
"Cut the crap," Del Rio said. "What do you want?" He had no trace of an accent. "Two sugars, some lemon." Cholo pushed the pitcher over toward me.
"Help yourself," Del Rio said.
I fixed myself up some iced tea and took a sip.
"Mango," I said. "Very good."
Nobody said anything. Del Rio folded his hands across his stomach and leaned back in his chair. He looked sort of stagey, like an Anglo playing a Mexican, with a Pancho Villa mustache and his dark hair slicked back. "Family okay?" I said.
"Yes. My daughter is married now and lives in La Jolla."
"You approve?" I said.
"If I did not, it would not have happened."
"Husband in your business?" I said.
"No. He is a marine biologist."
"Does he know your line of work?" I said.
"He did not marry me," Del Rio said.
"You have business with me?" A small fountain made a soft falling water sound in one corner. "I need two favors."
"Perhaps you're confused," Del Rio said. "This is not Traveler's Aid."
"One, I'm interested in a guy named Tannenbaum," I said. Del Rio looked up from his chessboard.
"Really?" he said. "Why?"
"A guy who works for him threatened to beat me up the other night on Olympic Boulevard."
"And?"
"And he didn't," I said. "But I'd sort of like to know why."
"I can see why you would," Del Rio said. "But why do I care what you'd like?"
"Because I'm a fine person."
"Do you know the name of the man who threatened to beat you up?"
"Jerome Jefferson," I said. "Guy with him called Tino." Del Rio shook his head. He looked at Cholo. Cholo shrugged.
"We don't know them," Del Rio said.
"Small-time guys," I said. "Don't waste the name players on a stiff from Boston." Del Rio nodded.
"It is good that you understand your position here," he said.
"How about Tannenbaum?" I said. "Is he a name player?"
"Yes."
"Tell me about him."
"First," Del Rio said, "you tell me what you might be doing that would come to Morris Tannenbaum's attention."
"I'm working on a murder case," I said.
"Here?"
"Some people involved used to live here," I said. "But the murder was out in the desert, place called Potshot." Del Rio moved one of the chess pieces.
"Is there a connection?"
"I don't know."
Of course you don't, Del Rio said.
Cholo moved a chess piece. Del Rio studied the move. I don't play chess. I had no idea what they were doing.